she's unemployed, has cancer across the street. My neighbor is a caretaker for his wife. They live under the poverty line, kind of cat corner, directly across the street. The family lives in poverty. They had their son, their adult son, was on house arrest, and their daughter, granddaughter, lived with them. Next door to them, the family, or it's not a family, the individual is a veteran. He didn't have electricity for a while. He's in recovery from drugs and alcohol. Nobody lives in the house beside me anymore because they had a wood-burning stove and the house caught on fire. In the alley behind me, a family lives below the poverty line, and their one-year-old infant drowned in the pool over 2 years ago. 3 years ago. 2 years ago, her uncle, who lives next door and lives directly behind me, died in a the 4th of July accident. The guy who lives next door to them has COPD. The guy next door to them is diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so I talk to people and I said, and say, what do we do about this? This isn't a random, that is a random segment of people, who live by me. And there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of trauma in this area. And the church is called to reconcile how the good news of Jesus Christ is good news for those people. And so, in rants that I have with people, I like to do that. I'll say, people are going to look at the little kids who lost their uncle and their cousin, tragically, and see them when they're adults and wonder maybe why they're on food stamps or why they're not functioning better than what they are. And sometimes the response I'll get, I think it's the church's job to do something about that, to which I agree, and I'm going to talk about why. But I say, it depends on what you mean by that. Do you mean that the church should take care of people with schizophrenia? Because I happen to know that our church, sorry to let the cat out of the bag, we couldn't afford to pay for the scripts for one person with schizophrenia for the year, let alone to dramatically change the community. And the response that I get sometimes is, sure. Literally, people will say, but what doesn't it matter most that they're saved? Which, to me, it's a pretty adamant response. We only say things like that when we're talking about the poor's problem, people living under poverty's problem. We only say that when we talk about other people's problems. If somebody called me from school, from daycare, and said that my child care, and said that my three-year-old daughter, was being bullied, it would be a very strange response for me to be like, well, she's good for the afterlife. She's baptized. I'm not worried about that. If my mom was diagnosed with cancer, couldn't get cancer treatment, then it would be perverse for me to respond, she's saved. So, if she passes away from this, she's going to heaven and not hell when she dies. And I think that the problem, this may step on some toes, but some of the problem is that we have a reductionist view of what we mean by Christ's salvation. We often mean that we have sinned individually and that Jesus died on the cross to save us so that we go to heaven and hell after we die, and to save us from our individual sins. And these are the sins, and we see how these culture wars are sometimes drawn. Almost all of these sins are, some of them are way more complicated than the way that they're presented. But that is the way in which modern Protestantism has kind of dealt with salvation in America. And the problem is that Jesus did come to save people from their sins, whatever those are. Drinking too much, stealing, being crass. The Lordship of Jesus does have things to say about that. But there are other ways that people suffer. They suffer from violence, from war, from greed. Death itself is something that Jesus came to defeat. And part of what poverty comes is this suffering that comes from want, for the need of medication, food, and shelter, justice, equal standing before the law. And one of the ways that you have to understand the Lordship of Jesus is to understand how Jesus was anticipated, how the Jewish Messiah was anticipated. And a lot of that is found in the book of Isaiah. And here in Isaiah, we see how the prophet actually, and the Lord himself, confronts people for being only concerned about their individual piety. It's not a matter of starving yourself and making yourself thirsty. That's not the fast that I'm looking for that's going to bring favor. It is that you divide your bread with the hungry and to bring the homeless poor into your house. So what God has always imagined for this world is all those things I talked about before, being defeated, death, violence, want. And Jesus came to address those things. So this is kind of God's image for the world. What did I just do? commercial break. I'm going to try not to hit that one again. Actually, can you just hit the space bar? I'll try it, but I might do it then. All right, I'll try this first. All right, so Isaiah anticipates the Lordship of Christ, and he does it with a few major passages, but one of them is the beautiful Christmas liturgy. Unto you a child is born, unto you a son is given, and the government will rest upon his shoulders. And the end of his governance will cover the world, and there'll be no end. It won't end with time, it won't end through violence. And he'll sit on David's throne forever, and he'll judge the earth justly. The zeal of the Lord will accomplish this. The prophet also says that the child will put his hand on the viper's nest. Men will beat their swords into plowshares. So all of the things that cause us to suffer will be reconciled under the Lordship of Jesus. And Jesus harkens back to Isaiah right after he's baptized and he goes into the wilderness. He comes into the temple and he defines his ministry. And his ministry is to preach the gospel of the poor, to proclaim the release of the captives, the recovery of sight to the blind, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. And he says, this prophecy is fulfilled in this gathering. He gets baptized, he goes in the wilderness. Right before he starts his ministry, he says, I'm about to fulfill the prophecy of Isaiah, which is to bring peace to the entire world. And as Jesus goes through his life, there's all of these times where what he's doing is bringing somebody who, for whatever reason, has been ostracized to the community back into the community. I'm surprised I didn't put Zacchaeus last, but Zacchaeus was actually a wealthy person who was extorting money from people. And even then, his wealth was causing him to be an enemy to the community. And Jesus goes to his house and he has dinner with him. He brings him into the community. The woman at the well, he shouldn't have even been talking to her. And he goes and he brings her into the community. I think you know the stories of all of these. When he gives an example of somebody who was righteous, he talks about a good Samaritan, the enemy of the people he was talking to. It would be like saying the good Muslim to a bunch of right-wing Americans. And he was a threat. That ministry of reconciliation, of saying we don't have barriers that separate people from people and we shouldn't have barriers that keep people from a relationship with God, was a threat to the authorities. One of the things that we have to understand as humans, and there's a lot of different people and traditions who've written about this, there is always an anxiety that comes from a community that wants to use violence against their enemies and wants to protect resources for people who are middle class and upper middle class. It is greed, and sometimes there's exorbitant wealth, but there's also just an anxiety that comes from illness, from a lack of having resources, from people who aren't like you. And Jesus is confronting that. And he wasn't always, they killed him for it. He made enemies. If you bring all the social outcasts into the fold and confront the majority, you tend to, the system doesn't like that. They resist that. That's what evil is. But Jesus is a critique on all of those things. And through that death and resurrection that came from the confrontation and deliberately advocating for the least of these, God vindicated Jesus' death and there was a resurrection. So God vindicated good. And therefore God exalted him to the highest place, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So that is what Jesus' work in life and ministry did. And this is just another verse that says that he's the image of the invisible God. So this person who cast out demons, who healed the lame, who gave to the poor, who said you should love even your enemies, even the one who kills you, that God is saying, that is my son. That is the destiny of humanity. That's what the world's supposed to be. And so, obviously, Jesus went to heaven, and he gave us the job of spreading the kingdom of God. And so, what we should do on behalf of the poor is a lot of things. But they kind of fall under a couple of umbrellas. One of them is we need to remind every earthly lord and authority that, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more, that they will be judged on how they treat the most vulnerable. We need to remind them of that. And the other thing that we need to do is proactively reach out and make relationships with people who are excluded from the community, like Jesus did. And we can't expect that we will always be appreciated for that. And I think I get into that a little bit more later. So this is just saying, you know, that Jesus said that we are going to continue his work, and whatever is bound on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever is loosed in earth will be loosed in heaven. So it's just the church are Jesus' representatives until he comes. Animated by the Holy Spirit, empowered by Jesus to do it. But we are his hands and feet until he comes. C.S. Lewis has a good quote that summarizes. So I think we need to consider who are the lords in this system. There was a reason why both Herods were intimidated by Jesus' work. It wasn't lost on them in the first century when he called himself Lord. They were making, among other things, a very political statement. And that wasn't lost on them. The Messiah, as in, you know, the Isaiah prophecy, was always a political position. I don't mean to say that they're running for public office. I mean to say it is the ultimate power and authority by which we'll be held accountable. And so Jesus talks, and he gives two ways, two different times, there's probably more, but I'm going to talk about two of them, where he says we will be judged, humans will be judged specifically in how they treat the least of these for eternity. One of them is when he separates the sheep from the goats. And he says that whatever you do unto the least of these, the poor, the destitute, the blind, the lame, people in prison, whatever you do to the least of these, you have done to me. And you will either be brought in as a sheep to heaven, or you will go to hell and suffer based on your neglect of the least of these. That was the parable of the sheep and the goats. Another time he gives the story of Lazarus. And Lazarus is this poor man who's laying outside the gate with sores on his body, begging from the rich man. And the rich man continually passes him by. And the poor man, when he dies, he goes to heaven and sits at Abraham's bosom. And the rich man goes into Hades. And as he's in hell, suffering, he says to Abraham, "Will you please tell Lazarus to dip his finger in the water and give some to me, and you know, in order to quench my thirst?" And Abraham says, recounts what the rich man did during his life and how he ignored him. And he said, "So now Lazarus is getting his comfort, and you're being tortured." And so the rich man responds and says, "Well, then send somebody to go and tell my brothers that they shouldn't treat the poor in that way." And Abraham responds, "They have Moses and the prophets. If they're not listening to Moses and the prophets, then why would they listen if somebody was said to him?" I mean, these are very, very scathing, audacious statements that Jesus is making of how you will be treated for eternity based on how you treat the least of these. So I want to talk a little bit about the church's work of reconciliation. Sometimes I get a little emotional when I talk about this one. But during the famous court case of Brown, I'll ask you to raise your hands in a second because I'm just curious. Brown v. the Board of Education, who remembers the Dahl experiment? It's kind of famous. Does anybody remember that? Just a few good. I'll give the whole thing a quick synopsis. So in Brown v. the Board of Education, somebody's suing somebody to integrate the schools. And this lawyer does this Dahl experiment to show that separate is inherently unequal. To keep the school separated is unequal. And he brings all these kids in, and there's a white Dahl and a black Dahl, African-American Dahl. And the lawyer says, "Show me the good Dahl." And these black kids point to the white Dahl. You know, "Show me the pretty Dahl." And the black girls point to the white Dahl. "Show me the evil Dahl." They point to the black Dahl. "Show me the Dahl that looks like you." And they point to the black Dahl. And finally, one of the kids says, he says, "Show me the evil Dahl." And the black kid points to the black Dahl. And he says, "That's evil. That's the N-word." What Jesus did and what our call to do is, as Christians, is to deconstruct that. However it looks in whatever culture. Anything that causes a dominant oppressive force to look down on another group of people, we confront and deconstruct that. Any internalized oppression that calls the black kid to see evil in a doll that looks like them, we deconstruct that. I'm not just that, no matter how it looks. And what I'm saying is, poverty is one of the ways that looks. And it's expressed pretty clearly in this book. This is a very crass comedian you name the sickest thing, she talks about it, she laughs about it. This excerpt I'm going to read doesn't do that. But it's an African-American woman who grew up in the ghetto, grew up in the hood in Atlanta, and she got pregnant when she was 12 by a 22-year-old, and she got sent to prison for doing crack, or selling crack. And she's talking about her mother, who was in the news, and telling all her friends that she was going to be in the news after there were all these murders in her neighborhood, and all the other parents were watching their kids, but this lady didn't watch her kids. And this comedian's making sense of, why would my mom want to tell everybody that I was in that she was in the news when she was basically in the news for neglecting her kids? And I just think it's a, for our purposes, it's a really good thing. I used to wonder why Mama was so excited for folks to see that she lost track of her own kids. But I came to think that it didn't matter what Miss Kaufman was asking the journalist. All that mattered was that somebody was paying attention. As long as she lived, nobody except caseworkers and police had ever asked Mama about her life. Nobody gave a damn. But Miss Kaufman leaned in close and really listened to Mama. For a moment, my mother was important. When most folks think about the problems of growing up in the hood, they think about what it must feel like to be poor or hungry or to have your lights cut off. The struggle nobody talks about is what it feels like to be invisible or to know in your heart that nobody cares. Mama didn't want us to be famous. She wanted to be seen. And then this is the comedian. All those years, I thought we were so different. But when I stepped on stage and saw all those faces smiling back at me, I realized Mama and I craved the same thing. So now what I want to do is I want to talk about, I've at least tried to establish who Jesus was and who we are as the church and what we need to do. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the landscape of just addressing poverty, still from a spiritual perspective. Deborah Stiles is going to talk about social work. She's going to talk a little bit more about what's going on in America right now. So why is poverty a spiritual problem? I think it is because it increases suffering. It gives a lack of resources and dignity, all of these things that I already just talked about. And sometimes, but I also think that there's some virtues, and I think it's important to recognize that some virtues can come, because I think even as middle-class Christians, sometimes we can be condescending to people who are living in poverty. And there's some good things that can come, some humility, dependence on God and not your own self-efficacy or wealth, faith in God. That was one of the things that always bothered me when people said, well, you know, if people just become moral, they'll come out of the poverty line. I know some very moral people that live under the poverty line, very hardworking people that live under the poverty line. The easiest way I ever make any money, and believe me, I ain't rich, but the easiest way I ever make money is in the stock market, and that's not doing anything at all. I mean, if you have a lot of money, you don't have to work hard to get wealth. Grit and a strong sense of community. I think we see that here when we feed people living under the poverty line here. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about wealth and why Jesus and how Jesus says that wealth can distort our vision. I don't think, and I've put a lot of thought into this, and I don't think that Jesus' critique really is much about wealth at all. It is about greed. And but they often go hand in hand. But he makes some very strong statements. Here's a couple of them. Woe to you who are rich because you've received your reward. Here's here's some problems with wealth. It causes us to be self-reliant, causes us to be blind in the suffering, and hoard resources. We make laws that benefit us when we become wealthy. And work, labor benefits the wealthy oftentimes more than those living in poverty. There's some opportunities that come from wealth. And that's one reason why I think it's important to keep your vision clear. I don't think that God wants us to squander our wealth. I think he wants us to make wise investments. I think he wants to consider how we spend our money. Because there's a lot of good that we can do with wealth. I mean, any of you who go, well, this church, any of you who go to either of the private universities, none of those opportunities are afforded to you without somebody producing wealth. The problem is that they get hoarded and that they get caught either in the top or even in the middle class. And we quit asking the questions of how do we get to people who are suffering. Part of that is because our human nature is to move towards people that look like us and have the type of stuff that we have and think the way we do. And so people are excluded and it takes effort to see people struggling in poverty. But that redemptive relationships and incorporation, I think that can come when people say, how can I spend not just money, but how can I spend what I do have to help people who are living like Miss Pat's mom or in those situations? With these last things, I think I even put critiques. But I think we need to look at America. And sometimes because we have that reductionist view of salvation, and we kind of know that salvation is to save us through our personal sins, so we go to heaven and hell when we die. A lot of the questions that would be answered or are answered by understanding who Jesus is as the Messiah. Our imaginations are often shaped by what it means to be American, by being individualistic, by being capitalistic, by being even democratic, by being nationalistic, which causes us to consider our own needs and our own safety of our own community and not to consider the needs of an immigrant who may have more opportunity here. All of those kinds of things come from being an American. And it's important that we constantly say, what are our priorities if Jesus is Lord? If we're going to be held accountable in those ways that I said earlier, then how should we think about all these things? Those are all things that I think we should think about. A hypothetical social ladder is not good enough. If too many people are living in poverty, that's its own critique. That suffering is its own critique. You can't go academically and say, oh, well, this shouldn't happen if they made all of these other decisions. You still have to ask, even if people are making poor decisions, which I think is a fundamentally flawed view to just assume that, even if there are poor decisions being made, why do they continue to get perpetuated? Are there things we can do about that? I cannot imagine Jesus saying, if people can't afford to pay, then they should just be sick. I don't even think earlier versions of human societies would say things like that. I don't think you had to tell tribal people why they should just let a number of people in their villages be ill. So those kinds of things are all questions that we need to ask, because what we're constantly saying is, the church constantly declares that Jesus is Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, everybody is incorporated into the community. And we're moving, and we're constantly supposed to be moving to this time where there's peace and prosperity for everyone, and everyone's included, then we constantly have to be agitating and holding authorities, earthly lords, accountable to that, how they'll be judged. And that brings me to my final point. When we talk about sanctification, It is as absurd as what I was saying about Miriam being bullied. For a Christian to say, well, you know, sure, I drink a lot. I'm violent sometimes. I like to snort a little coke. I like to smell. You know, but I won't be perfect until I die and go to heaven. So what's the point of really making a big deal about that now? There's something in most Christians that doesn't resonate with. I mean, we might say something like, man, I wish I quit struggling with this. But nobody says it's cool. But sometimes I think we kind of do that with justice. We rest. We just say, once Jesus comes back, all of these terrible things like unemployment and starvation and people not getting health care will be made right. We need to be just as dissatisfied with that. And if we aren't, then I don't think we understand what it means to proclaim Jesus as Lord.
Amen.
Continue with the table discussions, and about an hour we'll have lunch. So, go for it.
Talking to people closely, I'm like, yeah,
yeah.
This is cool. And then I'm like, whoa, I just sit down and too quiet.
Yeah. So we lost our table leader.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna get water then real quick.
I'm assuming.
Hello. My name is not Bill, but Bill had to leave for a second. Oh, it's so fancy. So. We were just gonna discuss. What did you guys think? What were your responses? I think there's a list of questions that he had too, actually. Like follow-up questions, but if anybody had any strong opinions, you can go ahead and share those.
I think the end was, I said this earlier, I think the end is super good because, the way we fight sin in ourselves and don't settle for that, just kind of being there. I think that's very common. Someone who's pursuing the Lord with all that they have is to at least recognize that this is something I need to address and work on it, and especially the blatant stuff. But when it comes to suffering around us, it's different to just see that and see the wrong in that and then not address it and just kind of look over it. Whereas if it was a critical flaw like that inside of ourselves, then we would be quicker to get to it. I think you need to be kind of right with yourself to help others. That kind of does make sense. That we would look internally first before we look externally, but I think we need to stress that both are of equal importance to God. That's my thought on that.
I like how we kind of have like a call to action. He didn't just tell us what the problems were. He didn't just tell us what the issues were with our society and what's wrong with the church and helping and the lack of help or how they help. He didn't just say what was wrong. He also told us to look at how to fix those problems ourselves, like practical way. They weren't just do better at helping the poor, you know. It was practical, legitimate ways that we can do that, and it kind of is refreshing to hear that, you know, we can't, like, help more than we think. Like, poverty, yes, may never be eradicated by any means, but it kind of is refreshing to hear that, like, it can be seriously helped. Like, we can do so much to help poverty. And that's kind of what his main goal was, I think. Was to show us ways that we can do it as Christians and just as people in general to really help it. So I thought that was nice to hear. You don't hear that a lot. you kind of always hear the negatives until there's no way we can beat it.
He didn't say it explicitly, but I've always been impressed that Josh and Amay chose to live in a poor section of Marion. They don't have to live where they do, but when he said, I have this neighbor and that neighbor and this neighbor, that's from, what, 12 years of living among the poor. And I think that's a basic decision that we all, some of us have made, some of us will make, of where are you going to live? What will your neighborhood be? I mean, Christ spent a lot of time with the poor. Sometimes they followed him around. Sometimes he was among them. And I think that the company you choose is important. Where you live.
I think that's a really awesome thing to pull out of that. That's huge.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I don't think I've ever pictured myself ever living anywhere besides somewhere, like, kind of, like, quiet and peaceful.
Yeah, that's where I live.
That's just something I've never...
Real quiet, real peaceful.
Like, when you said that, just for the first time, I think, possibly in... Like, possibly in my life, I just thought... Am I supposed to live there?
You don't think of it as a choice. It's almost like you have to keep moving, like, away from that.
Yeah. No, I live somewhere where, you know, I see police sirens go by, I see ambulances go by, but I seldom know who they're going to arrest or where they're going to pick up somebody who's overdosed. I hear lots of stories because my wife works in a poverty school, so I hear about her kids and their parents, but my neighbors are all doing pretty well, you know. It's not, I don't live in a neighborhood like Josh does. I admire his choice.
I mean, I grew up in Hamilton County, so like I was fortunate enough to know that I was going from Hamilton County. That's like, I have no idea what poverty is on a lot of levels, but ever since I came to the Wesleyan, I have learned that. Working in Maryland, it's a very different place. I'm not in Kansas anymore. Living here for 4 years now, so like it was really cool because I don't think I've ever thought about that either. So, like, you know, that choice of living, where you're living, because to me, one,